This is Monday, the 30th of January, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, protests across the country against and for President Donald Trump's executive order limiting immigration. Also ahead, evidence of opposition to the U.S. immigration moves by U.S. diplomats. We'll talk with VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Steve Herman, about that. And we'll have the latest for you on an attack on a Canadian mosque overnight. All on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has reiterated his feeling that the implementation of his executive order tightening immigration is going well. He also had some other things on his agenda today. VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas joins us live from the White House. Mary Alice, what's the latest?
Well, I mean, he has another executive order that he signed today, and that essentially is on regulations. Basically, for every regulation that is passed, he says at least two must be revoked. But again, a lot of the talk here is still on this ban of refugees from seven countries, something the president today says has gone very well. He said that yesterday was a very good day in terms of homeland security, and he's blaming any problems, this is through his Twitter account, that may have happened on other issues. He says only 109 people out of 325,000 were detained and held for questioning. He says big problems at airports were caused by Delta computer outages. Protesters and the tears of Senator Schumer, that is the top Republican senator who appeared on television with some people from one of these countries, and he actually got emotional when he was talking about how he felt this executive order was unfair. So the president today blaming problems on other things with regard to how this executive order has been implemented, despite reports of chaos and confusion just all over the country.
And it's all Delta Airlines' fault. Mary Alice Salinas joining us live from the White House. Mary Alice, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Sure, Ira.
Thousands of demonstrators, as Mary Alice just alluded to, as she just hangs up on us, gathered in front of the White House and at airports around the country to protest President Trump's executive order. VOA's Catherine Gibson looks at how the second day of protest unfolded yesterday in Los Angeles, New York City, and Washington, D.C.
Backlash against President Donald Trump's executive order reached his front yard Sunday. The assorted signs and varied chants.
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
All came together with one message.
The actions that the Trump administration are making are not the values of America.
And while protesters shut down a major street to make their way to the Capitol, supporters at nearby Dulles International Airport welcomed home American citizens returning from visits to Muslim countries.
I felt so happy. I felt so proud of it that I am still welcome over here. There are the people who are supporting me.
Attorneys and immigration advocates raced to airports to help legal immigrants left in limbo as the executive order came down.
This is our way of showing the world and even showing ISIS and Al-Qaeda, no, we love Muslims, we welcome them, we're going to support them.
The spontaneous scenes of airport protests happened across the country as officials sorted out court orders staying the president's executive order. In Los Angeles, lawyers remained at the airport to wait for the release of the detained.
The government is refusing to comply with a federal court order, refusing to provide any information about the number of people detained. We're here to demand the rule of law, to demand compliance.
And protesters said the new president had gone too far.
Trump doesn't have a mandate. He cannot issue executive order after executive order bypassing Congress, signing away people's rights.
But for many Trump supporters, the order is crucial to national security.
These people are stupid and ignorant. They forgot what happened back on September 11, 2001. It was an attack on our democracy. This should never be permitted.
It was a feeling echoed by counter-demonstrators at New York's Battery Park.
Do they understand she can't have a country without borders? All right, I'm here to represent the rest of America, the America that elected Donald Trump.
And while these protests will be just the first battle in a long fight ahead over the legality of the order, this second-generation Yemeni said he wants the White House to look far into the future.
They don't know what's going to happen in 6 months or a year. It's going to affect a lot of people, and people are going to be very angry with the United States.
Knowing the world is watching, these protesters hope their actions speak to some of that anger. Catherine Gibson in Washington, VOA News.
Joining us on International Edition is Steve Herman, VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent. And Steve, there's a story coming out about some diplomats, U.S. diplomats around the world, not too happy with the Trump executive order about immigration. What are you hearing?
Well, yes, we've obtained a copy of what's called a dissent memo that has begun circulating, and it is expressing objection to the ban, the executive order issued by President Trump on Friday, blocking immigrants and those issued non-immigrant visas from seven Muslim-majority countries for a period of 90 days. And the foreign service officers, the consular professionals, and members of the civil service are expressing opposition to this, saying it will not achieve its aims. It's likely to be counterproductive, and saying in one part of this dissent memo, quote, we are better than this ban.
What does this hold? What kind of power does this have behind it? Is it liable to change anything?
Well, this is a unique mechanism that was created during the Vietnam War about concerns with the government's handling of that conflict. And it's a way for employees of the State Department to confidentially express disagreements with U.S. policy. And they're not supposed to be subject to any penalty or disciplinary action for signing on to these memos. And most interestingly, I think, is once it's submitted, the State Department has to acknowledge its receipt quite quickly in a couple of days and then distribute it to the Secretary of State. And also, they have to respond officially with some substance within 30 to 60 days.
Now, of course, there is no Secretary of State yet, right?
Right, but we expect that Rex Tillerson will be confirmed this week, and so one of the first things that'll presumably land on his desk will be this dissent memo from the people that are reporting to him.
Steve, what is the mood? What is the overall tone of the State Department with this change taking place? You're there every day. What have you seen changing, and what's going on?
Well, we have not had a daily briefing for the correspondents who cover the department since this administration began because there's really not the top people in place. We should have had by now, according to many people in the building, nominees to fill the undersecretary, deputy secretary of state positions. A lot of those people have essentially been told that your services are no longer needed. They were political appointees. Sometimes they're kept on for a longer period, but they were under the understanding that once the new administration came in, that they could quickly be out of jobs. But the leadership of the State Department is very thin right now, and hopefully if Rex Tillerson is confirmed this week, things will start to improve on that front.
Has this had any effect on U.S. foreign diplomacy?
Well, that's hard to say. I think what we need to keep in mind is there are thousands and thousands of career foreign service officers and civil servants who are showing up and doing their jobs. And, you know, the building to some degree and the embassies to a great degree, even if there aren't ambassadors in place, do run. You've got these career deputy chiefs of mission who know how to run embassies probably better than a lot of the ambassadors, those who are political appointees that are sent over to run the embassies. So on that sense, yes. But I think there is a percentage of the foreign service officers who are very concerned, as we're seeing with this dissent memo. And on social media, I have seen some former Foreign Service officers urging their colleagues or former colleagues who are still there to resist and in some places quit. So will this just be some, steam coming out to relieve some of the pressure, or is this going to lead to something more significant with a lot of disenchanted people leaving the State Department who aren't just the political appointees? We'll have to see.
Let's get back to the situation with the diplomats and their expressed opposition to the executive order on immigration. Are we expecting similar type of disagreements coming from elsewhere?
We're already seeing them. Obviously, we have lawmakers here in the United States, Democrats, obviously, from the opposition, but also some Republicans expressing concern. And then notably, we have this statement issued by the human rights chief today saying that targeting specific countries is illegal under human rights law, which is international law. Now, of course, the new administration in the White House has pretty open disdain for the United Nations and many of its agencies. I don't think they're going to be too bothered by that. But it'll be interesting to see if there's momentum that gathers in the United Nations to take on the United States on this. Although I would caution that things tend to move, even when there's some urgency outside of the United Nations Security Council, that things sort of move very slowly through the process at the UN. But I think it is notable to see that there is also criticism coming not only from inside the United States, from the political opposition, but also now from at least one UN body.
Steve Herman is VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent. Once again, Steve, thanks so much for being with us. Let's turn our attention to Doug Bernard. He loves when people turn their attention to him, but he's following social media today. I'll bet it's pretty active.
I don't know that I'm that much of a ham, but it is very active today. You know, interestingly, there's a lot of chatter, speculation about who President Trump may name for his Supreme Court nominee. That announcement, we are told by the White House, is coming down tomorrow at 8 p.m. So at this point, it's just speculation. Nobody knows, and everybody's throwing names around and whatnot, so we'll pass by that. But there are two hashtags, competing hashtags, that I think maybe kind of get a good example of how social media reflects very quickly what's happening in the news. So the first hashtag we're looking at is hashtag boycott Starbucks.
No.
I know. It's tough for some people. The CEO of Starbucks has said that he intends to hire 10,000 refugees to work in Starbucks in the United States. And so a lot of people have been upset by that, those who have created the hashtag boycott Starbucks. Here's just a few of those. Instead of hiring 10,000 American veterans, Starbucks has decided to hire 10,000 refugees. Here's somebody else. Those jobs should go to Americans. You know, hey, Starbucks, watch your sales drop when the Trump train comes and boycotts you. That being said, I'll be honest with you, most of the people, I think kind of, it's the way that these hashtags can work. You can put something out there, and then it can very quickly flip around and kind of bite you. So
we shouldn't be worried if we own Starbucks.
No.
Mr.
And
Schultz,
not,
no.
Okay. No, no. So here's Robert Jones. Shout out to Boycott Starbucks. So I know when I get my quad shot caramel macchiato, I won't have to wait on a long line full of racists. There's a lot of talk like that. People have basically taken that hashtag over. Now, on the other side, there is a hashtag delete Uber. I'm seeing a lot of this on Facebook. The Uber did not participate in the boycott of various airports over the weekend, like Lyft did and like, you know, traditional cab drivers did. Also, the Uber CEO is one of Donald Trump's sort of kitchen cabinet of economic advisors. So people now are using this hashtag delete Uber. And I'll be honest with you, for all the talk that there is about, you know, people feeling good about sticking it to Uber and boo that, it also has turned around so that I'm seeing a lot of conservative comments saying, you know, the left has just completely gone bananas. No way this is going to have any effect. So two examples of how social media really very quickly amplifies, I think, things we're seeing in the news.
Doug Bernard, as always, a pleasure, and we'll get back together again tomorrow and talk about what's happening. And people want to sound off to you. How do they do it?
dbernard@voanews.com.
I thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump has continued to defend his executive order banning entry to refugees and people from seven Muslim-majority countries. Protests against the immigration change echoed throughout the U.S. over the weekend. There's been a fatal attack on a Canadian mosque in Quebec City. In the face of growing international and domestic criticism under a presidential decree, several measures have been introduced to ease some of the most controversial aspects of Turkey's state emergency. And Philippine police have ended a controversial anti-drug operation in response to the kidnapping and brutal murder of a South Korean businessman by anti-narcotics officers there. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory have found a fairly simple chemical analysis method could help scientists in the search for signs of life beyond Earth. The new test makes use of a technique called capillary electrophoresis, or CE. The CE technique, which has been around since the mid-1960s, is widely used today by the biosciences community. It's a liquid-based analyzation method that separates mixtures of organic molecules into its separate components. NASA's new extraterrestrial application of this test focuses mostly on amino acids, which are considered to be the building blocks of life. The NASA JPL researchers say this new search for life testing method is 10,000 times more sensitive than those currently being used by NASA spacecraft, such as the Mars Curiosity rover. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Just a bit more about that, what's now being called a terrorist attack on a mosque in Canada, shooting at a Quebec City mosque during evening prayers left six people dead in an attack that Canada's prime minister called an act of terrorism. Police arrested two suspects, including one who called 911 to say he was armed but ready to give himself up. There's a small company in the northwestern U.S. drawing global interest in a new tsunami survival option. The company's escape pod could also protect residents on vulnerable coastlines in the event of a hurricane or a typhoon. In either case, survival involves climbing into a spherical aluminum pod and buckling in for what is sure to be the ride of your life. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Ocean Park in the state of Washington, where he spoke with the first U.S. buyer of this new technology.
Jeannie Johnson just recently moved from the Seattle area to what she calls her dream home at the beach. It's about midway up the sandy, flat Long Beach Peninsula in southwest Washington state.
When I decided to move to the ocean, into a tsunami zone, I felt like I should prepare.
Geologic records show the Cascadia earthquake fault offshore is capable of generating massive tsunamis. In that case, Johnson's evacuation options are not good. She could make a run for high ground, but this Microsoft executive doubts she could reach safety in the short time between the end of the shaking of a great earthquake and incoming tsunami waves.
People panic, and I don't want to be caught in the panic.
A bit of internet research led her to a new option, a bright orange, high-strength floating metal ball. She's taken delivery and is now deciding whether to tether her capsule in her herb garden or keep it in the garage. In any case, Johnson wants her dog to join her if and when the big one comes.
Trixie, hop. Come on, baby. Hop. Let's go. Hop. Good girl.
My model is big enough for two people to be buckled in like a pilot seat.
So that you're going to get into this sphere.
Yeah.
And it's looks to me a little bit like an astronaut capsule, actually.
It does. It looks a little bit like it came from NASA.
The aircraft-grade aluminum sphere is about 1 1/3 meters in diameter. It has a round marine door and two tiny portholes. Inside, air supply tanks and about 6 days' worth of drinking water come standard. A dry powder toilet is an optional feature.
And I have friends who say, oh my God, wouldn't it be claustrophobic? How can you stand it? And all I can think is, what's my option to drown? I would rather be in that ball for the ride of my life and maintain my life.
Johnson is the first American customer of a startup called Survival Capsule, based near Seattle. Company president Julian Sharp says he got the idea for the product lying awake one night while spending the weekend at a beach town in Oregon.
I thought, well, what happens now if a tsunami comes?
The aerospace engineer had a brainstorm.
And I just thought, well, it's going to be a disaster because I've got four sleeping kids. If it comes at night, lights are going to be out. You know, you don't necessarily know where you're going. You can't see the wave, how far it is. So I thought it would be great if I had something I could design, throw the family in and ride it out. And that's where it all started.
While the inspiration for the product was tsunami survival, Sharp says his company's capsules are now drawing additional interest from people worried about hurricanes or typhoons.
Rather than evacuate from hurricanes and be 200 miles away while the hurricane decides it wants to go in a different direction, leaving their home vulnerable or business vulnerable to looting, they want to stay at home, have a tsunami capsule as a last line of defense.
At this point, you might wonder how much this peace of mind costs. Sharp says the two-person survival capsule starts at $13,500. A four-person model lists for $17,500. The company's initial sales have been to Japanese customers, eight capsule kits so far. Sharp anticipates local governments in Japan could become a major customer base, along with private sales to Americans. Survival Capsule has also held initial talks to license its design for fabrication in Indonesia, which might produce a lower cost for customers in developing nations. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Ocean Park, Washington.
Imagine a ride with a tsunami on one of those things. I don't know. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin. Thank goodness she's here. For engineer Dan Crafton, him too. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the fundraising and support network of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. In pursuit of that goal, on January 10, 2017, the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated four individuals as specially designated global terrorists, pursuant to Executive Order 13224, which targets terrorists and those providing support to terrorists or acts of terrorism. The individuals designated include ISIL members based in Iraq, Syria, and Indonesia who are involved in ISIL's propaganda, recruitment, and support networks in Southeast Asia and Australia. As a result of OFAC's actions, all property and interests in property of these individuals subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. The first designee is Neil Christopher Prakash, who was named for acting for or on behalf of ISIL. He served as ISIL's most senior Australian recruiter and encouraged others to travel to Syria and Iraq to join ISIL. As of June 2015, Prakash was publicly identified as a top ISIL recruiter who facilitated the travel of new recruits, appeared in high-profile ISIL recruitment videos, and was named in a list of key contacts for aspiring ISIL foreign fighters. Khalid Sharouf is a Syria and Iraq-based ISIL member who has been involved in distributing propaganda and carrying out executions on behalf of ISIL. Barumsia Menor Usman is an ISIL official who commands ISIL fighters, facilitates funding for ISIL operations in Indonesia, recruits for ISIL, and coordinates travel and communications for ISIL members. Oman Rahman was designated for acting for or on behalf of ISIL in the areas of recruitment and media dissemination, and as of late 2015, was considered to be the de facto leader for all ISIL supporters in Indonesia, despite his incarceration in Indonesia since December 2010. These designations aim to cut off ISIL's access to the international financial system and support the global coalition's efforts to disrupt ISIL's finances and defeat the terrorist group. As ISIL seeks to recruit individuals around the world, the U.S. government will continue to target its enablers wherever they may be.
That was an editorial.